I'm sure you'll remember the film Four Weddings and a Funeral, which came out in the 90s. 20 years ago. It's scary, isn't it? That was a film that shot Hugh Grant to stardom and incidentally resulted in me getting a lot of very strange looks whenever I went to the cinema because at the time I looked a lot like Mr. Grant. Or maybe Mr. Grant looked a lot like me, I'm not sure. Anyway, as we reach the last chapter in our series on the Book of Ruth, we've had a lot of funerals, but we haven't had a wedding yet. If you've missed the rest of the story, let me encourage you to read it for yourself. The Book of Ruth is just the most fantastic story with everything in it. But very briefly, Naomi and her daughter-in-law, Ruth, have been through constant hardships. Naomi and her husband, Elimelech, had to flee their home in Bethlehem because of a famine. Naomi's husband has died. Her two sons, one of whom was Ruth's husband, have also died. Ruth hasn't been able to have any children of her own. And now they are back in Bethlehem, in Naomi's hometown, living in poverty, right on the edge of society. Their story has been one of constant setbacks. So right at the start of our time this morning, and I'm quoting a phrase from John Piper here, I want to suggest that one of the main themes of this whole book has been this: the life of the godly is not a straight line to glory. The life of the person who seeks to serve God is not a four-lane motorway leading straight to your destination. It's a B road that winds through the hills, and there are rock slides, and there are dark forests, and there are steep precipices, and slippery curves, and hairpin bends that make you go backwards in order to go forwards. And if we lived in another country, I'd say there are wolves and bears. But, all along this hazardous, twisted road that doesn't let you see very far ahead, there are frequent signs that say the best is yet to come. The life of the godly is not a straight line to glory, but they do get there. The Book of Ruth is one of those signs for us to read. It was written to give you some encouragement and hope that all the perplexing turns in your life recently are not dead-end streets. In all the setbacks of your life as a believer, God is plotting for your joy. He's saying the best is yet to come. And so for Naomi and Ruth, despite all the setbacks, despite the twists and turns and hazards of their life, at every stage in the book, there have been glimmers of hope, signs of God saying, I have not abandoned you. The best is yet to come. We saw it in chapter 1, in Ruth's amazing promise to Naomi to stay with her. We saw it in chapter 2 as Ruth just happens to find herself in the fields of a man called Boaz, a man who turns out not only to be one of the town's leading citizens, a man of valor, a man of integrity and of honor and of godly character, but also he is related to Naomi. He's part of their family. And last week in chapter 3, we saw Ruth very boldly proposing marriage to Boaz on the basis that he would not only take care of her, but would also redeem Naomi's land and potentially provide Ruth with a son who would continue the family name. And the answer Boaz gives is, maybe. It turns out that there is someone else who is a closer relative of Naomi who has first right of refusal to buy that land. After all those funerals, the hope of the wedding at the end of the story that has been tantalizingly held out is snatched away again. It's another setback. Everything depends on this mystery guy, mystery relative who has a greater claim than Boaz. Chapter 3 ends with the suspense and frustration of yet another setback. And this setback, interestingly, isn't being caused by somebody doing something wrong. The only reason that this problem comes along is because Boaz is doing the right thing. He's being honest and principled. Sometimes the blockages along the life of the godly aren't caused by landslides or rocks or wolves. They're caused by honest workmen doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. So what's going to happen? Let's listen to chapter 4.
Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman."
Well, we'll come back to that and finish the end of the story in a few minutes. But first, let's just understand what's happened here. The city gate in ancient times wasn't just the place where you get into the town and the most logical place to look for fellow villagers coming and going. It's also the heart of the community. This is where the town council met. This is where important business transactions are done. The gate is the platform for local dignitaries. It was a pulpit for prophetic messages. And it was the hub of local gossip for the entire town. So whenever you read in the Bible about something happening at the town gates, it's a very public thing indeed. The whole of Bethlehem is about to discover what Boaz is planning. And Boaz finds the mystery man, Naomi's anonymous closest relative, and calls him aside for a discussion in front of witnesses. And the very first item of business that Boaz brings up, to our surprise, isn't marriage to Ruth, but rather the question of buying Elimelech's land. Remember, 10 years before this, there was a devastating famine that hit Judah, which is when Elimelech and Naomi and their family fled as refugees to Moab. And it's not been that long since the region recovered from that famine. People have been concentrating on getting their own land back into production after years of dried up fields and crop failures and food shortages. And so now that's done, the people of Bethlehem are in a bit of a better position to discuss other land issues again. And the mystery man considers what Boaz is suggesting. If Elimelech's land has been lying fallow, it's been lying unused, Mr. Mystery is going to have to spend a lot of time and resources into getting that land working again. But when Naomi dies, he will stand to inherit the land because she has no sons that it'll pass to. You can see the cogs going round in his mind. Even if it costs him a sizable chunk of money now, in the long term, it's a great investment. Great, he says, I'll buy the land. And we all groan because we don't want him to buy the land. We want Boaz to get it. But this is where Boaz makes his brilliant move that no one sees coming. He brings Ruth in as part of the bargain. She's the linchpin for this entire transaction. On the day you buy the land from Naomi, he says, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. And that changes what has up to now been a fairly routine purchase of land into a high-stakes gamble. Because any child produced from the union between Ruth and one of Elimelech's kinsmen redeemers, will be Elimelech's heir and will inherit his land. That's the whole business of the kinsman redeemer. What makes this a gamble is that Ruth is barren, or at least seems to be, has been for years. There is a good chance that she may never have children. If the mystery man marries her and she remains childless, the land becomes his and he's made a tidy profit. But considering how Yahweh has already been shaking things up in town through this young woman, there is no telling what might happen. Nothing is impossible for the Lord. And Mr. Mystery just can't take that chance. So he relinquishes his rights. Just like Orpah in chapter 1, Naomi's other daughter-in-law, the mystery relative isn't doing anything culturally or ethically unacceptable here. He is making a wise business decision based on sound economic principles. And if that's what your philosophy of life is about, go for it. The alternative is far riskier, far messier. We might even say it's foolish. But it's based on the principle of that word that we keep coming up against in Ruth. Hesed, love, grace, compassion, mercy. And that exposes the sacrifice that Boaz is prepared to make for Ruth. Because the cost for Boaz is exactly the same as it would be for the mystery man. Being a redeemer is expensive. He's going to have to make the same investment to get that land working again. And if he marries Ruth and she has children, they will inherit the land directly. Any children that Boaz already has, and we can assume that he already has a family and he already has children, those children will have lost out not only on the new land, but also on all the money that it has cost to buy it and getting running again in the first place. Of course, the irony here is that the man who was trying to preserve his inheritance loses his own name in the process. That's why I keep calling him the mystery man. Nobody remembers the real name of that other relative who passes over to Boaz the right to redeem Elimelech's land. So we all give a great cheer as Boaz finally gets the girl. He and Ruth head off to get married, and maybe at last the road ahead of them is clear. But even now, there is a cloud overhead. Ruth is barren, or at least she seems to be. In chapter 1, we were told that she'd been married 10 years to Mahlon, and there were no children. So even now, the suspense is not over. Can you see why I said that the lesson of the book of Ruth is that the life of the godly is not a straight line to glory? Life is one curve after another, and we never know what's coming. But the point of the story is that the best is yet to come. No matter where you are, if you love God, the best is yet to come. Let's listen to the final part of the story.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David.
I started today by saying the life of the godly is not a straight line to glory, but they do get there. Now, you might think that glory is a little over the top here. After all, it's only a child. A grandmother holding a little child after a long, hard life full of pain and heartache. But that's not the end of the story, because the best is yet to come. If this story of Ruth just ended in a little Judean village with an old grandmother hugging a new grandson, glory would be too big a word. But the author doesn't leave it there. In verse 17, he says very simply that this child, Obed, was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David. All of a sudden, we realize that all along, something far greater has been in the offing than we ever realized. God was not only plotting for the blessing of a few Jews in Bethlehem, he was preparing for the coming of the greatest king that Israel would ever have, King David. That's roughly when this book was written, at the time of King David. But today, we can look at it again and say that still isn't the end of the story. Because the name of David carries with it the hope of the Messiah, the new age, peace, righteousness, freedom from pain and crying and guilt and grief. This simple little story opens up like a stream into a great river of hope. Through the pain, through the bereavement, through the hunger, through the homelessness, through the fear, through the uncertainty, through every setback, the story points to Jesus. And Jesus points forward to the time when death will be no more, where there will be no more mourning or crying or pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. The best is yet to come.